we're moving, and the house is becoming more and more, and especially Boehner and his team have become more and more the problem here.
Senate members are frustrated by roadblocks to a debt ceiling deal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 22nd. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, some Anchorage Assembly members are troubled by a new ordinance proposed by Mayor Dan Sullivan.
Why is downtown any more important than Muldoon, Spinard, Eagle River, Chugiak, Midtown? It's a flawed ordinance.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news for over 26 years from Alaska's business sector, government, and industries. Information and subscription online at akbizmag.com.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Congress is gone for the weekend, even though there's no deal to avoid defaulting on the national debt. It also left without passing a bill for the Federal Aviation Administration, causing a partial shutdown of the FAA tonight. Flights will still go and air traffic controllers will be on the job, but thousands of other FAA employees will be furloughed, including 79 in Alaska. The Department of Transportation says Alaska could lose nearly $70 million in construction funding, and according to the FAA, $7 million of that is supposed to go to Alaska right now to places like Juneau, Anchorage, Kenai, and Barrow, and won't until the FAA bill is approved. There's just 11 days until the U.S. faces default and runs out of money to pay its bills. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Despite proposals in play and an initial demand by congressional leaders to stay in Washington and work, there's no deal on deck, and members who aren't the top negotiators are fleeing 100-degree D.C. Both of Alaska's senators are on their way home since there's nothing to vote on. Senator Lisa Murkowski says that doesn't mean this isn't crunch time.
Wall Street has kind of gotten used to us crying wolf on this and don't believe that we could actually not raise the debt ceiling. I think they are starting to get a little more concerned as they see that we don't have a clearly defined path forward.
Even though Murkowski and Senator Mark Begich are from different parties, they're united in their call for action on the debt ceiling. And both say they're willing to come to the table and compromise, but Begich says the hang-up is in the House of Representatives, where conservative Republicans are uninterested in any deal that includes raising revenue. And some Tea Party members say fear about defaulting on the debt is overblown.
If these guys haven't figured out on the House side where they're at, they better get on the stick, because they're going to drive this economy and this country into the hole because of their politicizing this issue. And I think the Senate has shown this week, Democrats and Republicans, through the Gang of Six and the McConnell-Reed piece, that we're moving. And the House is becoming more and more, and especially Boehner and his team, are becoming more and more the problem here.
The focus in Washington may be on the House, but Alaska's sole representative, Don Young, continues to be away today. He's been attending a fishing trip in Alaska that raises money for a charity named after his late wife. Young told Valdez radio station KCHU this week that he's not interested in the deals being crafted over in the Senate.
The House doesn't really have a whole lot of respect for the Senate side. And I know the House side is, you know, they are insisting on a certain amount of cuts and the equal amount to raising the debt limit. And I don't know where that's going to go, because if they don't get that kind of a deal, I don't think we got the votes for it. I mean, I'll be right up front with you.
Young told KCHU that he will be back in Washington next week to vote on any debt ceiling deals that do come together. On Monday, when Congress resumes, there will be just 8 days before the nation risks defaulting. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
At next week's Anchorage Assembly meeting, Mayor Dan Sullivan will present an ordinance restricting sitting or lying on downtown sidewalks. The mayor's proposal coincides with a homeless man's month-long protest on the sidewalk in front of City Hall and across the street. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Since June, John Martin has protested the municipality's policy of seizing and destroying the property of the city's illegal campers after a 15-day notice, or seizing and storing it after a 3-day warning. Martin manned his sidewalk protest during the day and occasionally through the night. At a Wednesday press conference, Mayor Sullivan said he had no intention of meeting with Martin.
I really try and limit my conversations with first-degree sex offenders. I really don't know what the discussion would be. If he needs social service help, there are social service agencies that can help him. If he wants a legitimate meeting, I think he came up to the office one time, and quite frankly, he needs to fill out the request to meet with the mayor for him and clean up and make himself presentable like a good, self-worthy human being would do.
Martin is on the state sex offender registry for a 1997 Level 1 sexual abuse of a minor conviction. Also on Wednesday, Anchorage police arrested Martin for failure to register his address. He posted bail and returned to the sidewalk. The mayor says his ordinance is not directed against Martin. Municipal Attorney Dennis Wheeler describes the Martin situation, irrespective of the protest, as something akin to a catalyst.
We had one person generate a whole lot of calls and complaints, what we think would be a whole lot of calls and complaints. Municipal staff coming to work, you know, seeing this guy on the sidewalk, walking around him, phone calls, hey, why is that guy there? You know, we looked at it and thought, you know, we don't have anything specifically that addresses the particular problem of somebody sleeping on the sidewalk.
At yesterday's Assembly Public Safety Committee meeting, Wheeler further explained the ordinance. He listed legal precedents he says indicates the law would be constitutional. Wheeler says that's one reason the ordinance only involves downtown.
We know that, constitutionally speaking, we can't have an area-wide, city-wide ban all the time. That's been tried. It was tried in Los Angeles. That was challenged in court, and the city of Los Angeles lost. Then we looked at where would it be most effective and most needed, and that's downtown.
The ordinance would also limit downtown panhandling on sidewalks. It would not ban sitting or lying down at approved community events, commercial business activities, bus waiting, or instances of illness. Some committee members voiced reservations, including Dick Traney.
Why is downtown any more important than Muldoon, Spinard, Eagle River, Chugiak, Midtown? It's a flawed ordinance.
If just downtown, Traney said the downtown partnership should cover any enforcement costs. Former police chief and committee chair Paul Honeman says he supports public safety, but questions the ordinance.
Frankly, I'm concerned about people's civil rights when they're going to protest against their government. I mean, we have pictures going back in the Vietnam era in the 70s where people are stacked two and three deep with their sleeping bags and their personal belongings, camping out, protesting the Vietnam War, and it was ruled that there was a First Amendment right to protest against the government.
The American Civil Liberties Union says it's still studying the mayor's proposal. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has released draft air quality permits necessary for exploratory drilling projects in Alaska's Arctic waters to proceed. Today, the agency released for public comment permits for drilling work proposed by Shell Oil in the Beaufort Sea and for ConocoPhillips in the Chukchi Sea. Public comments will be taken through September 6th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, more beaver dams may benefit coho salmon.
It's amazing to see the volume of beaver that have increased.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
A man missing off the Parks Highway north of Healy has been found dead, the victim of apparent suicide. 33-year-old John Robert Gage of Seward was an Alaska Railroad employee who'd been living in Healy. He went missing last weekend. His truck was found Wednesday night at a Parks Highway trailhead about 30 miles north of Healy. Gage's body was found early this morning, and troopers report that all signs indicate he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Gage was a lifelong Alaskan and a Marine. The biggest prospective gold mine in North America just changed its name. The joint venture rests in the remote interior of the Kuskokwim River. Plans to extract gold have been stalled by transportation and energy challenges, but the new moniker shows the company is serious about progressing to the next phase of development. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
In June, the board voted to change the name of the limited liability company from Donlin Creek to Donlin Gold.
The name Donlin Gold more clearly represents who we are as a company and the kind of mining that we're going to be conducting.
That's Kurt Parkin, External Affairs Manager for Donlin Gold. Donlin Gold is a smaller company run by two much larger companies. NovaGold, a junior mining company, is one. The other is worldwide mining giant Barrick Gold. Other partners include the Calista Corporation, which owns the subsurface rights, and the Kuskokwim Corporation, which owns the surface rights. Their goal is to begin extracting 1 million ounces of gold per year, starting in about 3 or 4 years from now. But before they can do that, they'll need permits, lots and lots of permits. According to Parkin, the board wanted to change the name of the company before the permitting process gets underway.
The timing just seemed to be right, so that as we go towards permitting, everybody will be able to associate the permit applications with Donlin Gold.
The name change is already in effect. Parkin says people should begin to see the new name in recent mailings and on new apparel the company is known to give away as part of their public relations campaign. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The Fairbanks Borough Assembly has approved spending $500,000 in state grant money to fund studies to assess trucking in natural gas from the North Slope and distributing it in Fairbanks. Voters will be asked this fall whether the publicly created Port Authority should be able to pursue a trucking project and whether the Assembly should fund a necessary due diligence study of it. The ordinance was sponsored by Mayor Luke Hopkins. Hopkins told the Assembly it's a key step.
The important thing of this ordinance is that it doesn't speak to whether it's the Port Authority or Golden Valley or, as I said, a third party or fourth party that has a trucking project that they are considering. It's to look at the question of, is this a viable business model?
Fairbanks State Senator Joe Thomas helped shepherd funding for the studies through the state legislature. Thomas said the current situation amounts to the worst energy crisis he's seen in 60 years of living in Fairbanks, and the studies are a way to help the public assess the gas trucking option.
To clarify, these monies are not for the Port Authority and they're not for Fairbanks Natural Gas. I realize there's a sensitivity and a concern over the legality of potentially the Port Authority changing from a gas line project to a trucking of gas project, and also concern about the price that AGPA might potentially pay for Fairbanks Natural Gas. This has nothing to do with that. It's just so people can get a better understanding of exactly what the project would amount to.
Thomas noted that if new exploration in Cook Inlet finds significant natural gas, support for an in-state gas pipeline from the North Slope will evaporate. The ordinance approving the expenditure of the money for the studies passed the Assembly 6-2. Anecdotal reports from the public have revealed that beaver activity has grown in northern Alaska and looks to have an impact on salmon. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
Steve Ivanoff is a lifelong fisherman and resident in Unalakleet. He says the increase in beaver activity, he thinks, is due to both the warming climate and a decrease in beaver hunting and trapping. The meat was often used to feed sled dogs, now mostly replaced by snow machines. And Ivanoff says North Face and Mountain Hardware has replaced some of the prevalence of the traditional beaver hat.
Some places of the river on the main system, every bend has a beaver compound, whether it's in a dead slough or on the riverbank. And I've actually seen them try to build a dam across the main river system, which of course failed. But it's amazing to see the volume of beaver that have increased.
With the increased activity, there are more dams, which bring an increase in still ponds. Biologists and fishermen believe that the increase in the amount of still water has benefited one species of salmon, the coho, or silver salmon. There hasn't been a formal study on the correlation, but observation from biologists and subsistence fishermen make a strong argument. Alaska Department of Fish and Game fisheries biologist Scott Kent says dammed water is a great place for young coho salmon growing in fresh water. He says when coho fry hatch in the spring, they swim upstream.
And try to find a
a pool or a side channel or a back channel, someplace to get into or some slower water. And there's typically a lot of zooplankton and micro and macro invertebrates in these areas. And the coho, during their first year of freshwater growth, they'll feed on these invertebrates. And those habitats tend to be pretty productive.
Kent says the beaver activity creates what's called habitat permanence and thermal permanence.
Because the water's deep, constant temperature, and there's just more habitats for rearing and to mitigate some of the effects from freeze down.
But the increase in beaver activity isn't beneficial for all salmon species. For example, the Department of Fish and Game has seen a chum run diminish east of Elam.
These fish are very unique. They run in the fall, and they go up this little creek, and they spawn in the lake. And there's been a lot of beaver activity there. And there seems to be a correlation between the increased beaver activity and what we've seen is a downturn in production from that run there.
The reason chum and pinks do not adapt well to beaver habitat is because they do not jump over obstacles, like the coho. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week on AK, a peek inside a military training exercise. Recently, an anti-terrorism battalion of Marine reservists were in Alaska for a two-week training. One focus of the exercise was hand-to-hand combat. Reservist trainers say fighting up close with insurgents in civilian clothes is different than past wars where uniforms clearly identified the enemy. APRN's Lori Townsend spent time at the training in June and has the story.
Sergeant Nathan Brown is from Bessemer, Alabama. He's the kind of guy you'd want around if there was an attack from just about anything, from enemy insurgents to grizzly bears. He has immense muscles, a calm demeanor, and lots of specialized martial arts training.
In 2008, I got my black belt instructor for our martial arts program, which we call MCMAP, stands for Marine Corps Martial Arts Program. We've designed our own program. It's been formed from a mix of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, karate, a lot of civilian techniques that are out there.
Sergeant Brown watches as another instructor shouts commands to Marines spread in rows across a grassy field. Listening to the instructor could make you queasy as he teaches techniques to break bones and crush skulls.
So use your entire body to make these strikes devastating. If you execute these on an unarmored opponent, he is going to be down. He's going to be hurting. All right? Ready. Execute.
As Sergeant Brown looks on, he reflects on the growing civilian interest in mixed martial arts. But this training is not a sport that ends with a title belt.
Our techniques typically end in combat zone where you want to come out alive. So these techniques are designed to end with a kill and with a win. It's life or death situation, just like with our rifles or anything else we learn. It's hand-to-hand combat. It's very important.
Sergeant Brown says the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan often involve up-close fights as Marines sweep through the neighborhoods trying to secure areas and root out insurgents that may be lying in ambush behind a bedroom door in a civilian home. As if on cue, the second instructor describes possible combat situations his students may encounter.
That's what I want. I want all the weight in your body onto that lead leg, destroying him, destroying that skull. Ready? Execute. Wipe it off.
Sergeant Brown politely takes his leave from my microphone and makes his way onto the field. Immediately, he becomes authoritative and barks instructions to the young men standing ready, eager and serious about learning techniques that may mean the difference between making it out alive or not.
That is a whole different technique called the axe stomp. This is just the one in the tan belt syllabus to give you multiple weapons in your arsenal, okay? Tan belt syllabus, you got the vertical stomp.
Also observing the Mi'kmaq trainees is a man most Alaskans know as a Parnell administration official. But here, he is not commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, but rather Major Dan Sullivan. Starting in 1993 as an active duty Marine, Major Sullivan is now a reservist who has been called back to active duty twice. He is clearly proud of his younger colleagues.
A Marine Corps sergeant is a pretty special individual. And almost all the sergeants here have seen at least one, two, three tours in Iraq or Afghanistan. And although they're now reservists, they have experience that rivals anyone.
We drive to a firing range where Marines are working with the M249 Squad Automatic Weapon. Today, the reservists were pleased by a visit from the Anti-Terrorism Battalion Commander, Lieutenant Colonel Eduardo Janney. There are 11 companies in this battalion. Janney says it's one of the largest in the Marine Corps. A first-generation Brazilian immigrant, Janney has been in the American military for 30 years. He says reservists have a level of maturity that comes from juggling a civilian life, job, family, and the Marine Corps.
If you're working in a village in Afghanistan, or you're in the Middle East, or in Africa, or wherever the Marine Corps happens to deploy you, that experience you have at home comes with you. We can prepare a guy to be an infantryman, or maybe have a particular occupational specialty, but we're not going to give him the experience that comes with it that these guys get in their civilian jobs. So if you got a guy who's a pipe fitter or works up in the oil fields, when he goes off to active duty and he goes to a small village and now he's dealing with a villager who's got some kind of issue with a water cistern, he's going to know how to deal with it.
Janney says in his 3 decades of service, one of the biggest changes he's seen is in the knowledge of the force.
We're a lot more intellectual. I mean, it's not uncommon if you were to take a cross-section here to find young enlisted guys that have master's degrees nowadays, where when I started out as an enlisted guy, nobody had a master's degree. You'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who had a bachelor's degree.
After 2 weeks of intense training, the men return to civilian lives at car dealerships in Soldotna, ranches in Montana, and college accounting classes in Alabama. Not knowing when they'll be deployed, but certain the orders will come, saying they'll be prepared and ready when they have to go. For AK, I'm Lori Townsend.
Now it's time for our weekly trip around Alaska. We'll go first to Minto, an Athabascan village smack dab in the middle of the state. And then we'll head south to one of the best places to net a sockeye salmon right now, Soldotna, on the Kenai Peninsula.
My name is Cheryl Charlie. I'm the tribal administrator, and I'm here in Minto, Alaska. It's about 3 hours from Fairbanks. We're off of the Hall Road. It's a small village. It's a lot of fun. People are going out in boats, checking to see how the berries are. We're all anxious to go out and pick blueberries now. And since it quit raining and the sun's been out, we're hoping they look pretty good right now. Quite a few of our village members, people from Fairbanks, their families are going to be going over to Old Minto next week for a camp, cultural camp. Usually we would take an elder silver. They will tell us stories, show us how to do games. They'll show the younger kids how to cut fish, hang fish. In the evenings will be story time, games, just stuff like that. We could have like between 70 and 80 people will show up. It's kids, grandkids. People's been looking forward to it all summer.
My name is January Yeager, and I'm the project coordinator for Soldotna Chamber of Commerce. Soldotna proper is probably about 4,000 people, but the area encompasses so much more. We're so close to Kenai that we're really, you know, kind of the twin cities here. And the surrounding areas of Sterling and Kasilof, it makes up to where we're probably more like 10 or 12,000 people. It's grown a ton. In the last probably 20 years or so, we've really had a huge influx of folks. And then, of course, in the summertime, we grow really, really, really big with all of the fishermen and all of that stuff that come down to enjoy the Kenai rivers. It's hot. It's very hot. Sunday was a record number of sockeye in the river, and then on Monday we had 177,000. I think there was like 85,000 the day after that. So people are catching them left and right. The limit's been increased, and it's just hopping around here. Ted Stevens Day is July 23rd. So that group is putting on a concert in the park with a beer garden. So that will be going on from noon to 10 on Saturday. This weekend is a big weekend for us here in Soldotna. We have Progress Days going on, and we have a parade that starts at 11 a.m. in downtown Soldotna, and it follows Binkley Street down to Warehouse Avenue. And we've got probably 75 to 80 different entries into the parade. Progress Days, it's to celebrate Soldotna's progress, where we've been, where we are now, and where we're going in the future.
That was January Yeager in Soldotna and Cheryl Charlie in Minto. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK on Alaska News Nightly. To see pictures and video of the Marine Reservist training, go to our website at alaskapublic.org. We had help this week from Heather Arono. Tune in next week when we go hunting for rare pieces of Alaska history in the most humble of places, the yard sale. I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Lorelei Kanin in Nome. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington and Heather Arono in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.